On this week's 51%, a sociologist takes us into the world of horse-crazy girls.
Women talked about feeling safer with horses.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
What is it? What is it with girls and horses? She says...
In Horse Crazy, Girls and the Lives of Horses, Horse Crazy sociologist Jean O'Malley Halley explores the meaning behind the love between girls and horses. Halley contends that this relationship and its cultural signifiers influence the manner in which young girls define their identity when it comes to gender. Halley examines how popular culture, including the pony book genre, uses horses to encourage conformity to gender norms, but also insists that the loving relationship between a girl and a horse fundamentally challenges sexist and mainstream ideas of girlhood. I spoke with Halley about her latest book and what factors drove her to focus on the topic.
Well, my family, I should mention, was had a lot of trouble. There was a lot of alcoholism and some gendered violence, and so coming from that world, I was not very good at being social with other humans. I was really shy, and my horse was the one that filled that gap. So he was my best friend. I spent a lot of time with my horse and was, you know, as I said, I was really, really horse crazy. So I grew up out west in Wyoming and Montana, and when I moved to the East Coast, I now live in New York City. I had a little girl who went to a public elementary school in Harlem, of all places, a very diverse, wonderful little school where she became completely horse crazy. And it was so surprising because we live in Harlem and, you know, there's not that many horses around. And so I couldn't quite figure out what was happening. And it was actually not just her, but other girls at her school. So I began to recognize that this is a phenomena that's much bigger than my own little individual experience. And I tried to, you know, study it a little bit. I explored what I hoped to find, the literature on horse craziness among United States girls. And it turned out there really wasn't any. So I'm a sociologist, and I usually study things that are more sad. You know, I've studied, done a book on racism and a book on the meat industry and things like that. So it was really kind of nice to think, wow, well, maybe I'll be the person to take up this topic. And I aimed the book for a more general audience. I really wanted more people to read it outside of the scholarly community. So I hope to have it reach that audience. The more I began to explore it, what I kept hearing back from women and girls is, oh, that's me. And from men, oh, that was my sister. My daughter is horse crazy. So a lot of people were really enthusiastic about the topic, and that kind of fed the fire, and I kept going with it. It was a lot of fun to do.
You say your work is based on a social theorist, and maybe you could speak to his work and how that influences your work.
Yeah, well, I'm a feminist. I call myself an intersectional socialist feminist, and so I used a lot of feminist thought about gender. And then I often use this social theorist, Michel Foucault, and I tried to kind of, I mean, his language can be a little hard to access, but I tried to write it in a way that made him more accessible. I don't talk a lot about him, but there's some about Foucault's work in the beginning and the end of the book in particular. And essentially what I borrowed from Foucault was an idea about how human beings in a particular society become what they understand to be normal and what normalist means. And so, you know, my argument was based on the idea that their normal is always bound up with a culture, so that cultures define it very differently. And I was interested in what it's meant now, but also over the past, you know, 70-some decades, for girls to be normal in the United States, and how normalness in some ways constrains girls and others too. Everybody, I think, to some extent, gets constrained by ideas of what is normal. And I was exploring the ways in which horse crazy girls, I think, both fulfill, they tip their hat to society and the demands of society around what it means to be a girl, but they also really challenge normal girlhood. And in that, I found the whole phenomena of horse crazy girlness to be really, you know, empowering and healing and life-giving.
Interesting. Yeah. I wanted to more about that because, again, I'm just going right back to my childhood and how I felt I was living a parallel life to my school life.
Interesting.
My whole friend circle was really in the horse world. And I only wanted them at my parties. It was like, leave your Barbie dolls at the door for the birthday parties. Like, just bring horse gifts. And there was always the Briar horses that, you know, arrived and everything. That was much preferred. But wow, I'm going off on my tangent. Let me get to the more interesting topic, which is your work. And you contend that girls are able to develop relationships with horses, and those who do are afforded opportunities. And you kind of just spoke to this, to challenge cultural expectations to ways of being, you know, normal. So what are these, and maybe you could expand on this, what these expectations are and how by being girl with horse or horse crazy that is challenged.
Yeah, nice question. And by the way, it wasn't a tangent at all. That was really, you know, perfect fit with what my work describes about girls who are horse crazy. Your experience as a girl was, it fits right in. I think on the one hand, horse crazy girls tend to be animal lovers. They're animal people. And so the women I spoke with, I did a lot of different modes of research, but for one chapter in particular, chapter 6, I did in-depth interviews with 25 women who had identified as horse crazy when they were girls. And there was a wide range of ages, from like 19 was the youngest to a woman in her 90s who has since passed away. And interestingly enough, even across all those generations, there were a lot of similarities. So I found that on the one hand, these women, they're animal lovers and they were as girls, and so they kind of act out the caregiving that is expected of girls in our society. Girls are meant to be sort of instinctually caregiving and good with caring for, you know, small animals and other children, and there's a lot of pressure on girls to do that. And I found that these girls did do that. I mean, the caring for the horses was a really big piece of what it meant to be horse crazy. And in fact, most of the women, 21 out of 25 were still horse crazy, and not only horse crazy, but really were involved or were about to be involved with horses, you know, still now. So you'd hear a lot of language about how, oh, it's, you know, women are good with horses because it's instinctual, or girls are good with animals because it's their nature. So there was that sort of tipping of the hat to, you know, what's demanded of girls in our society. And I'd like to add that I think it's actually something really important. I mean, caregiving is important work. And in our society, we could learn to take a lesson from girls who are horse crazy, because they take that work very seriously. And I think often the people who end up doing it are women, and they do care about it, but they don't have the resources to do it the way they'd like. They don't get, you know, women don't get paid for doing most of the domestic labor at home, and they end up often, the women in the U.S., doing two shifts, one unpaid shift at home and one paid shift at work, and that indicates a society that isn't really valuing caregiving. That caregiving should be something that as a society we support, that we set aside funds so that people have, you know, the capacity to do, for example, childcare in a way that gets them a living wage and where they have education about it and so on. So that was one piece where girls kind of step into what's considered normal, and yet they take it seriously. And as children, they have the luxury of being able to do that, whereas adult women often have to do, you know, as I mentioned, a couple different jobs at a time and don't have that luxury. On the other hand, these girls challenged normal girlness or normative girlness in that instead of being, you know, completely or more focused on caregiving, and instead of being focused on heteronormativity and sort of, I'm going to get married one day, I want to be thin and beautiful for boys, instead of being boy crazy, these girls were horse crazy. And that was, you know, it often was really in contrast to being boy crazy. So instead of focusing on their appearance, these girls were not interested necessarily in things like thinness. They didn't want to be frail. I mean, really, to be a horse person, you need to be strong and tough and willing to risk danger. And I'm not saying that girls who are boy crazy are not strong and tough. I think they are. I'm just saying that there's a difference in how they enacted it in their bodies. So these girls, you know, to be thin and frail and to try to be the sort of what's considered a beautiful in our society for girls doesn't necessarily prepare you for dealing with an animal that's over 1,000 pounds. So these girls wanted to be strong, and they dealt with manure. You know, it wasn't pretty pink stuff. It was stuff that was dirty. And they got their feet stepped on, and they had numerous accidents. And it was like a real challenge to sort of normal girlness where, you know, in a society that uses girls for boys as an example of what not to be. Oh, you run like a girl. You know, you're acting like a girl. Don't be a baby. You're a girl. Those kinds of taunts are an indication of how our society has understood girlness. And I think these girls were not, they wouldn't fit, right, with those taunts. They actually were self-asserting, strong, and in the world. So those are the pieces of kind of normal girlness that I thought Horse Crazy Girls both took up on the one hand of caring and challenged on the other hand of self-asserting. And what was interesting is that it happened, all of it, within the context of relationship, which is, of course, something that girls are socialized to do, right? Caregiving is in part about relationship. And so these girls had a really profound relationship with a horse. You know, and or for girls who didn't have a lot of access to horses, the ones they had access to really mattered, and they had lots of fantasy life about the horses in their lives that were also, I would argue, pretty empowering fantasies. I think that what happens for a lot of girls who are drawn to this is that it's a world where they can be girls who are a bit unusual. A number of girls women that I spoke with described their childhood selves as being misfits. There was probably a higher percentage in the population, I think there is, but certainly was a higher percentage in my interviews of women who identified as lesbian. And, you know, a lot of women who talked about how when they were girls, they were, you know, especially the older generation, women talked about, they used the term tomboy. So they weren't what they were supposed to be. They were tomboys instead. I think that probably there's a sizable percentage of horse crazy girls who have a situation like I had at home, that they aren't necessarily safe at home, and so this is a place where they go to be safe. So I think there are things about the culture that make some girls really look for a place they can become, you know, become the person that they are, and horses offer that. For example, a lesbian woman I spoke with who was at the time in her 60s, she's since passed away, but she said that when she was a girl, so now she would be in her 70s, you can think back, you know, to the 40s and 50s, she had no place to go with her lesbianism. She knew she wasn't interested in boys. She was not going to be boy crazy. The stable was a place where she could be who she was and where she found a sense of belonging and a sense of strength and capacity that was, you know, we all need in life, but it wasn't going to happen in her, you know, in her school, for example. I think that's a piece of how it comes about, how girls end up getting drawn to it. Of course, consumer culture, I mean, in a capitalist society, you know, there's a lot of interest in making a profit by companies. And so if they see something that people are interested in, they're going to go for that as a way to make profit. And the consumer culture has, of course, responded to horse craziness with a lot of, you know, cultural phenomena from TV shows, movies, to toys and so on. And some of that, I think, has actually been pretty liberating for girls as well, but it definitely feeds the fire. So girls, you know, have a way of discovering horse craziness without necessarily ever being around horses. And my sense was for those girls who really don't spend time around horses, I had a number that I interviewed had some access. Everybody had a little access to actual horses, but very little. And one said, you know, look, it was my fantasy life. For 6 years, she was completely horse crazy. She had books about horses. She had the Briar horses. And she played horses with her friends. They would either be horses or they were riding horses. And she said, you know, even our fantasies were really challenging of gender norms. We were out there on horses saving someone. We were out there on horses having an adventure. Or perhaps we were a horse that was wild. And she, you know, as she put it, we weren't princessy. These were really fantasies that put us in a position of feeling, you know, powerful and mattering in the world.
And it didn't involve being saved by, you know, a prince or a princess, depending on your preference. It didn't rely on those kinds of childhood fantasies.
Exactly. In fact, it was the opposite. I mean, most of the fantasy stories and the stories that have come out by and about Horse Crazy Girls do tend to be stories where it's a girl who's the hero. And it's a girl who's, you know, really brave. And it's a girl who manages to pull off the impossible, which is kind of wonderful for girls to see themselves in that way.
I wanted to know if the women you interviewed, especially the older ones, did they have a degree of success career-wise? Because with all this empowerment and, you know, a feeling of confidence that one gets from riding and the relationship a female has with a horse, how does that impact career choice, success, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I can only tell you about what I found, you know, in the people I spoke with. So it's not a perfect, like, you know, it's not a random sample. So I can't really generalize. But my sense was that having been a horse crazy led them to being girls and then later women that felt like they could look for what they wanted out of life. And so that most people that talked about their career life seemed pretty satisfied with it. You know, it was a life that they had chosen and wanted. And I think it'd be a great thing to study. You know, how does that differ from girls who had more normative or more quote unquote normal visions as girls? What happens in life between those groups that differs? I did find that one interesting thing was that a lot of these women did value caregiving in a way that was, I don't know what word to use except for maybe unashamed. They didn't necessarily feel like they had to be, the women I spoke with, successful in the kind of capitalist terms, which is, you know, to make a lot of money and sort of have power in the workplace. They tended to, like, a lot of them were still involved with horses, and a lot of their involvement with horses was not instrumental. So there were a whole bunch were involved with the horse rescue movement, which is about as non-instrumental as you can get, because there's really nothing that you gain. You know, you can't necessarily, with a horse that's rescued, these are horses that are potentially going to be sent to slaughterhouses. Largely women go, they purchase them instead of the slaughterhouse, you know, people purchasing them, and they keep them, often horses that have basically, they can't even be ridden in many cases, or the ones that can, you know, really they're just lesson horses. There's not a lot you can do with them. But women are putting an immense amount of time and energy into that. And in fact, from my sense of, I went and did some ethnography at a couple places that did rescuing. It's mostly women who are volunteering that run these operations. One of the women I spoke with was involved with a rescue organization in New Mexico, and she said out of all of the many dozens of volunteers that made the thing possible, she could think of no one who was a man, and the vast majority were over 60. So it was even, you know, kind of this thing a lot of older women are getting interested. And so that's putting your efforts towards something that isn't going to necessarily increase your salary or make you, you know, look good in the world. It's really about something, like I said, non-instrumental, you know, life mattering for itself, that I found to be really lovely. I'm thinking about, like, I, you know, women, there were a couple who became professors. There were some who were veterinary assistants. But they were clearly doing things that they had chosen because they wanted to be doing them, by and large, almost everybody. And not necessarily positions that, you know, like some have some at least social status, perhaps being a professor, one might say has social status. But a lot of the positions weren't things that would even get any kind of a limelight. And yet they were, you know, by and large, women who were really satisfied with what they were doing. I did have some real rock stars. Like the woman in her 90s was a well-known left-wing activist who'd been involved with political movements all her life and was very well-known within those movements. So it wasn't, I mean, she was, you know, a kind of a celebrity in certain circles, but she was also committing herself to things that don't necessarily, you know, certainly don't bring money or that kind of prestige.
You know, let's talk about the size of horses and the play of girls and horses there. You know, you're able to have this gentle giant, you know, yeah, which to an 8-year-old child, even a large pony is big. So to have to be able to command or be at peace with or whatever is going on, you know, and not be challenged by something that size is quite a feat in itself.
I agree. And I'm so glad you said this because it reminds me to mention something. And that is, of all the interviews I did, women talked about feeling safer with horses. And many women said, this is where I felt the safest. I was really surprised when women used that language in the interviews because it was definitely how I felt. It was the place where I felt safe was with my horse. And the irony of that is that women seem to, a lot of, you know, former horse crazy girls, women today, seem to experience that sense of safety with an animal. And I think it's, you know, a piece of what you're pointing at about the size. But the irony is that, of course, horseback riding is a very dangerous sport. Some sports scholars argue it is the most dangerous sport, which is debatable, right? American football is obviously really dangerous, but it's probably up there in the top four dangerous sports. And so to have girls who are not understood in the popular culture to typically be brave, be the ones who dominate a sport, at least on the, you know, maybe not at the very high top levels of the sport, but in general, it's a girl world, is pretty interesting. And not only do they dominate it, but they actually feel safer. So I was really intrigued by that. What is it about horses that makes them feel safer? And I think what you're pointing to is a big piece of it, and that is that girls feel one with horses. And that's even the goal as a rider, right? We want to feel one with the horse. We want to look like we're one animal and that no other viewers can tell when we're actually interacting with the horse. It just seems like we're doing it without, you know, as if we have a shared consciousness. So that oneness, I think, is a pretty amazing thing to have with an animal that's so big. You know, there's a way in which you are safer in that sense, in a certain sense.
so many questions and so little time. I really need to broach with you this I didn't know this, about the side saddle. Now, I always thought women riding in side saddle, I just thought, what a skill. I couldn't imagine riding in a side saddle. You know, how the side saddle evolved to quell the fear that riding would sexually arouse women. I had no idea about this. And you actually, in some of your interviews, your interviewees acknowledged occasional arousal. I was wondering if you could address this, because in a way, I'm almost offended.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's kind of what the sense I had from the interviewees, and certainly was my sense when people have asked me, well, what about, you know, the sexual arousal that girls have? Of course, there's a long, you know, history and psychoanalytic thought of the horse being, for girls who are horse crazy, a penis. You know, that's how they get to have a penis. They have penis envy, and this is, so it does fit into a larger sort of historic analysis that, in my opinion, is in many ways profoundly sexist. But on the other hand, we're humans, and in a lot of things we do, you know, we can feel sexually aroused, we can feel angry, we can have all kinds of bodily reactions. And this is one of those things. Was it a primary reason for riding? Not for anyone I've ever spoken with or any of my experiences in the horse world has that been addressed as a possibility, even, that the sexual part is the thing that women or girls get out of this. What's interesting to me is that culturally in the popular culture, and certainly, you know, even now, but in past decades all the more, there's been such a focus on it. And I think that says something. It's the focus that I think says the most to us, and that is, I would argue, we're very afraid of women's sexuality and girls' sexuality. We don't want them to be sexual. We want to control and contain that. And so an experience where they might have some sexual response is, in, you know, a place where a lot of focus goes. And yes, at one point, part of that focus in the Western Hemisphere, for sure, was to have women ride with their legs closed. You know, so in our culture, I mean, you sit on the subway, you can look around at the men and women, and you'll see women have their legs closed, and men will often be kind of spread out with their legs open. I mean, that's a response to socialization. Women are supposed to keep their legs closed. They're supposed to not want sexuality. They're supposed to protect their sexuality. And so the whole, you know, in normative or normal culture historically, and so the whole issue becomes important when they've not only got their legs open on a horse, but this powerful animal is between their legs. I think that, like I mentioned, the fascinating piece is how much attention has been given to it instead of to the many other reasons that women talk about riding mattering for them. But definitely there were, you know, one woman said that when she was a girl, she did have orgasms sometimes when she rode. And I actually did an interview with her trainer, and he said he knew she had those. You know, he had known about it. So it happens.
When you finished this book, did you want to explore any topics further?
Oh, a whole bunch. I'm very interested in equine therapy. What is it that makes it work well? You know, and in what areas of therapy, be it physical therapy with someone who might, you know, like I spoke with women who were using wheelchairs or people who have trauma histories, it seems to be really successful in a number of areas. So I'd like to know why and what the difference is between them. So that was one thing I'd love to research more. The other thing is I was really interested in and worried about the whiteness of the horse crazy girl world. I didn't do a random sample, so I can't, like, you know, really generalize, but my sense from my own experience, from the interviews, from the ethnographies I did, and from what the women said to me is that it is dominated by white women. So I'm kind of curious about that. How is whiteness being reproduced in that world? I should mention at the same time, it also seems to be a world where probably, statistically speaking, there are more queer girls and queer women than are in the general population, and as well, more women who have a disability of some kind in the horse crazy world than there are in the general population. So it's not that I think it's a world where there are groups of marginalized girls, but for some reason around race, there's this this thing of whiteness, which I would like to know more about.
What was your, or still is your favorite pony or horse book? Gotta know.
Oh, gosh, I have so many that I love, and there's a whole bunch that are very feminist that came out of the United Kingdom between the 1930s and 1970s. So probably my favorite author is an English author, Christine Pauline Thompson. She was in a family of three girls who started writing pony books and published them when they were girls. So that's interesting. There's a lot of girls who wrote those pony books that did it as children. So they were literally writing their own dreams for other girls. They were the authors of their own stories and fantasies. But from the U.S. books, probably Marguerite Henry's my favorite, and I'd say either Misty of Chincoteague Or I love the book she came out with called Mustang, Wild Spirit of the West, about Wild Horse Annie, who was an actual figure who did, you know, a lot of political organizing to stop the slaughter of Mustangs. So those are some of my favorites, but it's hard to tell. I really still enjoy those books.
Something else you wanted to mention, Jean? You've been so gracious with your time. I'm super appreciative. But please feel free to mention another aspect that
you really wanted
to get out there.
I just love this interview. It's been a lot of fun, so thank you so much. I would love to mention that I think horses give us an opportunity to consider our relationships as humans with non-human animals more generally. We're rather arbitrary in the animals we love and in the animals that we don't, you know, particularly protect or care for. And so, the meat industry is one such place where animals, if you look into how it operates, it's a pretty brutal world, even though the animals are, you know, like in the case of pigs, they're smarter than dogs and they're more loyal, and yet they're treated really brutally in that world. We delineate some animals for one, right, for factory farms, and some animals to be our family and our close friends. Horses are interesting because they cross that line. They are the family and best friends of the girls that came up again and again in my interviews, and yet if a family can no longer afford a horse, or the horse is lame, or what have you, you know, the girl may have gone off to college and the parents are like, we can't really do this anymore. An alternative that many people have and still use is to send the horse to a slaughterhouse, thinking that's a way to euthanize and not lose money. Because even, you know, euthanizing your horse and disposing of the body can be a few $100s. It can be expensive. So I'd like to just note that we do with horses something that we wouldn't ever think of doing with our dogs or cats. You know, you can't imagine sending your dog to a slaughterhouse, but it happens with horses. And at least, people estimate at least 120,000 or so a year are sent to slaughter in Mexico or Canada where it's illegal to do so. Legal, not illegal. And I'd like to just raise, you know, that Horse Crazy Girls, I think, are offering us an opportunity to think about care and to think about our relationships with the non-human world, and to take it really seriously, you know, and to maybe reconsider how we interact with that world.
That was Jean O'Malley Halley, author of Horse Crazy, Girls and the Lives of Horses. She's a professor of sociology at the College of Staten Island and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1593.